This program is intended for a print impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News covering Milford and its surrounding towns. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Paula Simchek. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the July 19th edition of the Milford Daily News. Ashland Town Manager Michael Herbert is on leave for an undisclosed reason. When reached on Friday, July 17th, Select Board Chair Brandy Kinsman declined to say why Herbert was on leave, or whether he took a leave of absence or was placed on leave. She also said she could not comment on how long Herbert had been out or when he will return. Herbert could not be reached for comment on Friday. He is out of the office, and his assistant town managers Catherine Bird and Beth Reynolds have been assigned his duties, Kinsman said. During Wednesday's select board meeting, Kinsman also said Herbert was out of the office, and out of an abundance of caution, Herbert sent a letter, as required by the town charter, to town clerk Cindy Livingstone to inform her that Bird and Reynolds have decision-making and signing power while he is out. The letter was sent to Livingstone on Tuesday, July 14th. Bird's title is Assistant Town Manager for Administration and Operations, according to the town website. Reynolds is Assistant Town Manager for Community Development and Community Affairs. Herbert has been Ashland's town manager since 2016. During two select board meetings in June, the board met in executive session to discuss contract negotiations with Herbert. Herbert was recently named one of America's 250 public service champions by the National Academy of Public Administration and Local Government 250. A Natick man who murdered a Framingham man nearly 20 years ago in Boston has been granted parole. The State Parole Board on Wednesday, July 15th, announced that it has granted parole to Oscar Rosa, who fatally stabbed Craig Vieira, 32, in 2006. The Parole Board ruled that Rosa will serve 6 more months in a minimum security prison before he is released to a long-term residential program. The stabbing occurred on November 26, 2006. Rosa and several friends had gone to the Embassy nightclub in Boston, where Vieira was a security guard. At some point, Rosa, 20 at the time, and his friends were ordered to leave. Authorities said Vieira was speaking to the group outside to try to keep the peace when Rosa stabbed him in the stomach and fled. Rosa was later arrested and initially charged with assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. Vieira, a bodybuilder who also worked as a personal trainer in Natick, was treated at a Boston hospital and released. However, on December 8th, Vieira died, and the state medical examiner's office ruled his death was the result of complications from his injuries, and Rosa's charges were upgraded. A Suffolk Superior Court jury found Rosa guilty of second-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison, with the possibility of parole after 15 years. Vieira's mother, Sybil Vieira, could not be reached for comment on Thursday. But during Rosa's 2008 sentencing, she spoke about how her son's death affected her and others. "There is no way of truly expressing what a loss this world suffered the day my son was taken from us," she said at the time. "The world was a better place for him being here. We are all better for having known him, and he will be missed forever. The values that he brought to those lives he touched cannot be explained in words." According to the parole board, this was Rosa's third bid for parole. The latest hearing was on February 26th. In its ruling, the parole board noted that Rosa had completed 4 programs since his previous hearing. It also stated that with sufficient supports and programming, Mr. Rosa's release is compatible with the welfare of society. Once released, Rosa has to be home between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. every day, be on a GPS monitoring bracelet for 6 months, remain drug and alcohol free and submit to testing, undergo mental health counseling, attend Alcoholics Anonymous 3 times a week, and to enroll in the Community Justice Support Center for assessment and services. Concord native Ty Andrews was determined to become the fastest person to summit Mount Everest, and after seemingly endless training, he succeeded, besting a 23-year-old record by a full hour by making the trek from base camp to the top of the world in 9 hours and 55 minutes on May 27th. "It's still a little surreal," said Andrews, 35, who now lives in Ecuador. "What I feel most is relief. I'd failed at it 6 times before this. Mostly, I'm just grateful it finally came together." "Ascending felt better than expected," he said. "I've been confident on that mountain 6 times before and had it fall apart, so I didn't let myself believe it until I passed the south summit and could actually see the top. Fortunately, the weather was in his favor. Our team meteorologist had winds at essentially 0 to 10 miles an hour at the summit, the calmest of the entire spring, after weeks of jet stream," Andrews said. "There was a nearly full moon lighting the whole route, and the mountain was empty. I was one of only 3 people to summit that day." Andrews kept his normal rhythm going the day before his climb, riding a stationary bike, having breakfast, and watching a movie with his partner. "The whole goal is to stay calm and boring," he said. Working with Human Powered Health in Wellesley, which offers a platform that uses advanced technology to assess and improve one's individual physiology, helped him enormously this time around, he said. The testing Human Powered Health did find real gaps, especially in strength and the load-bearing capacity needed to carry weight efficiently at altitude. "For the first time, I added serious gym work, and they helped me dial in fueling and my lactate threshold work," he said. The bigger shift was philosophical. "I'd always approached Everest like an ultra-runner, all lightness and speed. This year I trained like an expedition climber. The body I brought to the mountain was genuinely different." Evan Hoyt, a performance physiologist with HPH, where clients are put through various assessments for health and performance, said Andrew's record-breaking Everest climb is amazing. "We look at people's goals and tell them where on the spectrum they are, and through exercise we give them a path forward on how they can achieve their goals," Hoyt explained. "Someone does not need to be an apex athlete to benefit from an HPH assessment. Last week I worked with a 75-year-old woman who was sent to get some screenings for her doctor. Tomorrow I'm going to work with an Olympic marathoner from Canada," Hoyt said. "People who want to lose weight or improve their exercise level come for testing to help reach their goals." The most challenging part of the climb for Andrews was the Khumbu Icefall, which surprises people who expect him to say the death zone. It's a constantly moving glacier full of ice blocks the size of buildings, and you cross crevasses on aluminum ladders in the dark, he said. "You can hear avalanches rumbling around you and can't tell how close they are. The danger there is completely outside your control. You just move fast and hope." Mount Everest is the world's highest peak at 29,031 feet. Asked if he ever considered turning back, Andrew said he turned around 6 times before on previous attempts, but not this time. "On a previous attempt, I turned back 380 meters from the summit while on record pace because I was alone above Camp 4. It was windy, and I was going to run out of oxygen right around the summit," he said. "That's how you get frostbite or worse. Deciding to turn around when the top looks close is the hardest thing in this sport, and it's why I'm here to talk about it." A meaningful moment was calling base camp on the radio from the summit at 5 a.m. He heard his parents on speakerphone from Massachusetts and spoke with the rest of his team and partner down at base camp. "At the finish, I was pretty wrecked and really just wanted to lie down," he said. As for what's next, Andrew said he still could use a year away from Everest. "Running is still my first love, so I'm signed up for the UTMB, Ultra Trail Mont Blanc, the Super Bowl of trail running, at the end of the summer, and I'd love to chase a third Olympic Trials marathon qualifier. The no-oxygen Everest record is still out there, but not from the south side. I've been through that icefall for the last time." Running through the western CWM at midnight was what Andrew said he enjoyed most. "They call it the Valley of Silence, and Everest has its reputation as a circus, but I had that entire enormous glacial valley completely to myself," he said. "Full moon, so I could turn my headlamp off, total silence, and these impossibly big walls all around. There's nothing else like it." Antiquated laws in Massachusetts affect when consumers can buy alcohol, what stores can be open on Thanksgiving, and even where the public can walk on the beach. While the public has a right to walk on even private beaches on the wet sand below high tide in most coastal states, in Massachusetts, private property owners have ownership over the beach area down to the low tide line. However, certain activities on private beaches are legal. Summer isn't close to over yet, so here's what you need to know about beach rights in Massachusetts. In most coastal states, the use of the land between the low and high tide marks is governed by the public trust doctrine. This concept in property law dates back centuries to ancient Roman law, according to the Massachusetts Office of Coastal Zone Management, and states that all rights in tide lands and the water itself are held by the state in trust for the benefit of the public. In most states, this doctrine is interpreted to mean that public ownership begins at the high tide line. But Massachusetts Bay Colony legislators in the 17th century wanted to encourage private wharf construction on the intertidial flats, and so they changed the ownership to the low water mark, but not more than 100 rods, or 1,650 feet, farther seaward of the high water mark. These colonial ordinances, passed in 1641 to 1647, make it so the public is no longer allowed walk on a private beach in the private tidelands or the intertidal zone between high and low tide. You'll have to get your feet wet if you want to walk on a private beach. While the ordinance means the beachgoers can't take a stroll on exposed sand on a private beach, private property owners technically cannot interfere with the public's right to walk along the submerged land. The colonial ordinance also gives the public 3 specific rights on private beaches for fishing, fowling, and navigation. Over the years, the state courts have determined these to include the right to seek or take any fish, shellfish, or floating marine plants from a vessel or on foot, to conduct any activity involving the movement of a boat, vessel, float, or other watercraft, and the right to hunt birds for sport and sustenance. This means that you can do things like fish with a fishing rod or launch a kayak from a private beach. Indeed, knowledgeable beachgoers are often seen walking with fishing rods in hand or shellfish equipment so as to claim access rights under the colonial ordinance, wrote Richard Betstein, a real estate litigation attorney whose explanation on the laws was linked by Massachusetts state website. These rights cover other modern activities too, like surf casting and windsurfing. The attorney general has also said these rights cover bird watching, according to Betstein. But the rights do not include walking on the beach, sunbathing, or any other recreation unrelated to fishing, fowling, or navigation. To do those activities, you must get permission from the landowner. There are no private property rights in the water, so you can swim in the water in the area between the low and high tide mark, the intertidal zone, as long as your feet do not touch the bottom. Below the low water mark, however, you can swim and touch the ground all you want. Longtime Westboro High School principal Brian Callahan has taken a new position in Shrewsbury as he will leave the school he has led since 2013. Callahan was chosen on July 8th as the new Assistant Superintendent for Well-Being and Community Systems for Shrewsbury Public Schools. In his new position, Callahan will be part of a team overseeing programs involving student performance, mental health, and working with families to improve student outcomes and experiences in Shrewsbury Public Schools. Shrewsbury Superintendent Tiffany Ostrander, who took over the position earlier this month from Joe Sawyer, who retired after 17 years as superintendent, said during the July 8 meeting that in order to find the best candidate for the position, a search group put together a portrait of an ideal candidate, which Callahan fit. This individual needed to be supportive and student-centered, have strong communication and collaboration, is innovative and provides opportunities for continuous improvement, is data-informed, and is a strategic leader and has already established community partnerships, Ostrander said. Mr. Callahan consistently distinguished himself across these dimensions, and as the process progressed, it became increasingly clear that his leadership experience and approach closely aligned with what our leadership committee identified as essential. Callahan has spent the last 14 years as principal at Westboro High. Previously, he worked as an athletic director and assistant principal for Westboro Public Schools, and previously worked as a history teacher in West Boylston Public Schools. Ostrander said throughout his career, Callahan has demonstrated the skills needed to succeed in the position in Shrewsbury. Mr. Callahan brings 30 years of educational experience, including 14 years as principal at Westboro High School, following previous service as assistant principal, athletic director, and teacher, Ostrander said. This role requires someone that can lead and develop complex systems, while never losing sight of individual students and families. Brian brings extensive secondary education experience in supporting student well-being. Callahan told the TNG that the position in Shrewsbury fit the kind of role he wants to have in shaping education through meeting student needs. Throughout my career, I've been passionate about the holistic approach to students, focused on well-being and developing them as learners and people, Callahan said. Students can't learn until they are safe. That means being safe physically, mentally, and emotionally. I got into this work because of students, to put them at the center of everything. During the meeting of the Shrewsbury School Committee on July 8th, Committee Chair Rachel Sharifipour said that Callahan was the perfect candidate to fit the position after interviewing him. I was very much confident that we did find that unicorn that we were a little concerned that we wouldn't be able to, Sharifipour said. He stood out in that interview process in such a way about him that exuded confidence. He had so many ideas, not just from the last few years, but from his entire time, and he was very impressive. Callahan said that during his time in education, he has done literally everything, from teaching to driving school buses to serving lunches and serving as principal for the past 14 years. He said it was a difficult decision to leave Westboro, and that he will miss the people in the school when he departs. The energy that you felt every day from the students and people who work here, that will continue after I'm no longer here, but I will miss it, Callahan said. Our central office is in the middle of the school on the second floor, and you see everything. I won't see quite as many faces every day, so things will look a little different. Jack Foley, who recently retired as Gibbons Middle School principal in Westboro, will take over for Callahan as Westboro High principal on an interim basis, but only for the first semester of the 2026-2027 school year. Following Foley, Assistant Principal Kate Mercadante, who will be returning from paternity leave, will take over alongside current Assistant Principal Jessica Barrett, who will serve as interim co-principals. A permanent replacement for Callahan will be selected following a search next year. Callahan is expected to officially start with Shrewsbury Public Schools on Monday, July 27th. Although summer is still in full swing, some New Englanders may already be counting down the days until pumpkin spice lattes, cozy sweaters, and apple-picking trips return. If you're wondering what the weather will look like in Massachusetts this fall, the Old Farmer's Almanac recently released its 2026 fall weather forecast, a long-range forecast based on solar science, climatology, and meteorology. After a summer marked by heat waves and humidity, New England can expect cooler days as the season changes, according to the almanac. Here's what the Old Farmer's Almanac predicts for Massachusetts this autumn. The Old Farmer's Almanac forecasts cooler than average temperatures across Massachusetts this fall, with drier conditions in the east and wetter weather in the west. In eastern Massachusetts, considered part of the Atlantic Corridor, the almanac predicts September and October will be about 1 degree cooler than average, with about 1 inch less rainfall than usual. And in western Massachusetts, part of the Northeast region, the almanac forecasts below average temperatures and an uptick in precipitation compared with traditional averages. If you're planning your fall travel, here's what to know about autumn weather across the U.S. Temperatures are expected to be cooler than normal along the eastern U.S. and the west coast this fall, according to the Old Farmer's Almanac, but warmer than average temperatures are expected across parts of the northern plains, including Montana, the Dakotas, and Nebraska, across the heartland, including Iowa and Kansas, and into the deep south, including Tennessee, Arkansas, and Mississippi, the almanac said. While much of the country is predicted to experience drier conditions, some regions are expected to get more rain than usual, including the Pacific Northwest, parts of Nevada, Utah, and Colorado, and most of Texas, according to the almanac. Smaller pockets of wetter weather are also expected in southern Florida and the Northeast. This year, fall begins on Tuesday, September 22nd at 8:04 p.m. Eastern Time, according to the Old Farmer's Almanac. This is when the sun crosses the celestial equator. The autumnal equinox is one of two times this year when Earth's axis is tilted neither toward nor away from the sun, according to the National Weather Service. This results in nearly equal lengths of day and night. While North America, Europe, most of Asia and Africa, and the northern part of South America are all heading into fall during the equinox, countries in the southern hemisphere are about to experience spring. This includes Australia, Antarctica, most of South America, and the southern portions of Africa and Asia. 2 years after Eversource implemented the nation's first utility-scale networked geothermal pilot project in Framingham, the energy company is looking to expand the program. Eversource's geothermal pilot broke ground in 2023 and was implemented in Framingham neighborhoods the following year. The project uses underground wells and a shared loop system to provide heating and cooling to homes and businesses. The pilot program is being tested in a mile-long loop that serves 16 residential homes, 2 commercial buildings, and 108 Framingham Housing Authority customers. The geothermal system uses a heat pump that connects a series of buried pipes and moves heat-conveying fluid through the ground loop to circulate heat. During the summer, heat is pumped from the building to the ground loop to cool the building. According to a June 25th filing from Eversource with the Massachusetts Department of Public Utilities, DPU, the company is seeking approval to add 44 buildings, including single and multifamily homes, and the Framingham Public Schools Welcome Center to the system. The expansion would add 0.61 miles of main pipe and double the loop's capacity by 295 tons. Additional properties included in the proposed expansion are located on Flag Drive, Robertson Road, Normandy Road, and Denison Avenue. This would be the first geothermal network loop to connect with a neighboring loop, according to Eversource's website. Eversource said in the filing that it believes expanding the system would allow the company to gather additional data on larger geothermal networks and study affordability benefits for customers. The company also said the expansion would help determine whether networked geothermal systems can serve larger groups while continuing to reduce heating and cooling emissions. Eversource filed a petition with the DPU in May to seek approval for the expansion. In addition to approving construction, the utility is asking the department to approve a plan to recover project costs that exceed federal funding, authorize capital investments, and allow new participants to pay the same rates as existing pilot customers. The DPU accepted public comments on the expansion through July 17th as part of its review. Last December, the Home Energy Efficient Team, HEET, and Eversource received $8.6 million in federal funding from the U.S. Department of Energy's Geothermal Technologies Office to use for the expansion of the pilot program in Framingham. This DOE funding builds on the solid foundation we've established with HEET and the City of Framingham and allows us to explore how interconnected geothermal loops can further boost reliance, efficiency, and affordability, Eversource Vice President of Thermal Solutions and Operational Services, Nikki Bruno, said in a statement on Eversource's website. It's a critical step towards scaling this technology as a viable energy solution and a powerful example of collaboration between utilities, municipalities, and nonprofits like AGET. Even with the funding, Eversource estimates the project will require an additional $7 million to $9.7 million. The company proposes recovering the cost through its existing geothermal energy provision tariff, which is already used to recover pilot costs. Eversource is looking to have the expansion approved by September 30th to begin the design and implementation of the loop later this year. Over 3 years after a Duxbury mother was accused of killing her three children, the case is headed to trial in Massachusetts. Lindsay Clancy, a Connecticut native and Massachusetts resident, faces three murder charges in the death of her children in January of 2023. Clancy has since been held at Tewksbury Hospital for court-ordered mental treatment, but will now appear in front of the jury box at the Plymouth Superior Court. Wondering when Lindsay Clancy's trial will begin and how long it will last? Here's what to know. Clancy's trial is currently set to begin on Monday, July 20th. Judge William Sullivan decided that 18 unsequestered jurors will hear the case, more than the typical 12 to 16 jurors. It is unclear how long the juror selection process will take once it begins on July 20th. The Lindsay Clancy trial is expected to last somewhere between 4 and 6 weeks. Prosecutors estimate 4 to 6 weeks, while Clancy's attorney, Kevin Reddington, said he thinks it will be 4 to 5 weeks. The prosecution and defense have collectively named more than 200 people on the witness list, though it is unlikely that not all of them will testify. Lindsay Clancy is charged with 3 counts of murder for her 3 children, 5-year-old Cora Clancy, 3-year-old Dawson Clancy, and 8-month-old Callan Clancy. She was previously also charged with 2 counts of strangulation, but those charges were recently dismissed as redundant. Prosecutors argued that Clancy planned to kill her 3 children by sending her husband Patrick to pick up takeout and deliberately strangling them with exercise bands while he was gone. On the night of the alleged murders, Clancy also cut her wrists and jumped out of a second-story window in what appeared to be an attempt to take her own life. She survived the fall, but it left her paralyzed from the waist down and confined to a wheelchair. In October of 2023, Clancy pleaded not guilty to the 3 counts of murder. Clancy's legal team, including Brockton-based defense attorney Kevin Reddington, has filed a notion stating they plan to pursue an insanity defense, also known as lack of criminal responsibility. Reddington has claimed that Clancy suffered from postpartum depression and was taking overprescribed psychiatric medications at the time of her children's deaths. The murder trial of a Duxbury mother charged with murder in the 2023 killings of her 3 children is set to begin on Monday, July 20th. Lindsay Clancy is accused of killing 5-year-old Cora, 3-year-old Dawson, and 8-month-old Callan in January of that year. Prosecutors allege Clancy strangled the children using exercise bands in the basement of their Duxbury home while her husband, Patrick Clancy, was running errands. According to prosecutors, she sent him to a Kingston CVS and the 3V restaurant in Plymouth the night the kids died. Upon returning home, Patrick Clancy found Lindsay Clancy on the ground outside their house and their children unresponsive in the basement. Defense attorney Kevin Reddington has argued that Clancy was over-medicated and lacked criminal responsibility due to mental illness, including postpartum depression and psychosis. Clancy was paralyzed from the waist down after jumping from a second-story window at the house that night. She is currently being detained at Tewksbury State Hospital. Will Patrick Clancy testify at his wife's trial? Here's what to know. Patrick Clancy, the children's father, now lives in New York City, according to the Commonwealth's and Defense's witness lists. He works remotely for Microsoft, according to a November 2024 article by The New Yorker. The Duxbury home where his children were killed has been sold, Patrick Clancy told the magazine. The New Yorker article stated Patrick Clancy would not comment on his marital status out of deference to Lindsay. In April 2024, he ran the Boston Marathon wearing a jersey emblazoned with his children's names. Patrick Clancy is included on both the Commonwealth's and defense team's list of potential witnesses who could be called to testify during the trial. However, being listed does not mean he will actually take the stand. In Massachusetts, both the prosecution and the defense submit lists of prospective witnesses to the court as part of the trial process. Other witnesses included on the Commonwealth's list are Massachusetts state police troopers, Duxbury police officers and firefighters, local doctors, medical examiners, as well as some of the Clancy's friends and family members. Other prospective witnesses listed by the defense team include family members, friends, doctors, and the Clancy family's nanny. The head of the Hopedale Park Commission is facing additional charges a week after Hopedale Police filed a criminal complaint against him in Milford District Court. Both the Hopedale Police and Milford Police Departments on Friday, July 17th, filed criminal complaints against Michael Costanza, chairman of the Hopedale Park Commission. Hopedale Police charged Costanza with identity fraud, larceny of less than $1,200, and receiving stolen property worth less than $1,200. Those charges stem from an incident on October 16, 2025, according to Milford District Court records. In the Milford case, Costanza is charged with three counts of forgery of a document. Milford Police Chief Robert Tosino said Costanza is accused of visiting a Milford hardware store and signing different town employees' names on invoices to purchase items. Tosino said Costanza was identified by security cameras. The incidents occurred on June 12th and June 22nd. On July 10th, Milford Police filed a complaint charging Costanza with three counts each of identity fraud, larceny of less than $1,200, and receiving stolen property worth less than $1,200. Those charges stem from incidents on June 12th and June 22nd, according to court records, the same dates as the alleged Milford incidents. Costanza could not immediately be reached for comment on Friday. Neither Hopedale Police Chief Ricardo Lima nor Select Board Chairwoman Glenda Hazard could be immediately reached for comment. Lima declined to comment on July 10th after the initial case was filed. Costanza is due in Milford District Court on August 7th for a clerk magistrate hearing. The IHOP in Harvard Square has closed permanently after two decades in business, the breakfast chain said. A sign posted on the restaurant's window at 16th Elliott Street in Cambridge this month read simply, IHOP's Cambridge location has closed. IHOP franchisee Mark Justice confirmed the closure in a statement. We greatly appreciate our neighbors' patronage for the past 20 years and look forward to continuing to serve them at our location on 1850 Soldiers Field Road in Brighton, Massachusetts, Justice said. IHOP's Cambridge location first opened its doors to hungry college students in 2006, as reported by the Harvard Crimson. The restaurant, located about a five-minute walk from Harvard Yard, served a menu of pancakes, waffles, French toast, bacon, and eggs, along with other classic American breakfast staples. Dishes also included comfort foods, such as country fried steak, hamburgers, and mozzarella sticks. Though IHOP is known for its many restaurants with late-night or 24/7 operating hours, the Cambridge location was open from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., according to its webpage. When reached by email Thursday, July 16th, IHOP did not give a specific reason for the restaurant's closure. There are 20 remaining IHOP locations in Massachusetts, according to the pancake chain's online store locator. Attleboro at 383 Washington Street, Braintree at 755 Granite Street, Brighton at 1850 Soldiers Field Road, Brockton at 540 Westgate Drive, Dedham at 260 Providence Highway, Framingham at 17 Edgell Road, Hyannis at 790 Ayano Road, Milford at 17 Medway Road, North Dartmouth at 47 Fonts Corner Road, Northborough, 4102 Shops Way, and Norwood at 1378 Boston Providence Highway, in Plymouth at 10 Shops at 5 Way, in Quincy at 181 Parking Way, in Revere at 105 Squire Road, in Salem at 2 Traders Way, in Saugus at 114 Broadway, in Shrewsbury at 70 Boston Turnpike, in Springfield at 270 Cooley Street, in Tewksbury at 95 Main Street, and in West Springfield at 640 Riverdale Street. It's mid-July on Cape Cod, meaning the return of the Barnstable County Fair is right around the corner. Taking place at the Cape Cod Fairgrounds in Falmouth over 7 days each July, this historic county fair has it all. Fabulous fair food, thrilling amusement rides, exciting entertainment, livestock exhibitions, petting zoos, and more. Looking forward to attending the fun-filled Falmouth Fair this summer? Here's what to know before you go to the 2026 Barnstable County Fair. This year, the Barnstable County Fair will take place from Monday, July 20th through Sunday, July 26th. Hours are 4 to 9:30 p.m. Monday through Thursday, noon to 9:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday, or noon to 8:30 p.m. on Sunday. Rides close at 10 p.m. on Sunday and 11 p.m. every other day. The fair will take place at the Cape Cod Fairgrounds, located at 1220 Nathan Ellis Highway, Route 151 in East Falmouth. The Barnstable County Fair will have various forms of entertainment, such as magic shows, jugglers, live music, stunt shows, and livestock demonstrations, including open cattle shows, petting zoos, a youth sheep show, and plenty more. Aside from entertainment, the fair will also have at least 30 midway rides, including roller coasters, carousels, and slides. When you're hungry, the fair has plenty of fair food to try, including classics like hot pretzels, burgers, fried chicken, and cotton candy, as well as options from an array of global cuisines. Plus, those 21 and older can enjoy a beer and wine garden on site. Admission to the Barnstable County Fair costs $20 for adults, $10 for children ages 6 to 11, or $15 for seniors and military. 3-day passes are also available for $50, and children ages 5 and under enter for free with a paid adult. Tickets can be bought in person, but online purchasing is recommended to avoid long lines. Tickets for midway rides are sold separately in the midway area, with prices of $1.50 for one ticket, $25 for 25 tickets, or $40 for 40 tickets. Unlimited ride wristbands, which can be bought online or in person for $40, are valid during the following times: Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday between 4 and 9 p.m., ride until 11 p.m., Friday between noon and 8 p.m., ride until 11 p.m., or Sunday between noon and 7 p.m., ride until 10 p.m. More than 100 Democrats in the House of Representatives, including the entire Massachusetts delegation, voted to cut U.S. aid to Israel on July 15th. While the measure still overwhelmingly failed, 314 to 104, the volume of Democrats who voted for it highlighted a deepening divide in the party and a major foreign policy realignment in American politics for a longtime U.S. ally amid wars in Gaza and Iran. The proposal offered by Representative Thomas Massie of Republican Kentucky would have cut Israel off for more than $3 billion in American taxpayer-funded assistance. While Republicans fell in line in opposition, Democrats, even at the highest ranks, openly disagreed about it. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat California, and Representative Catherine Clark, Democrat Massachusetts, the current minority whip, voted for the measure. "We should not provide a blank check for military aid to any country that does not comply with U.S. law, interests, and values," Clark said in a statement ahead of the vote. While Democratic members will make different decisions on this amendment in good faith, we are absolutely united in our shared goal of permanent peace. However, Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat New York, voted against the measure, as did Representative Steny Hoyer, Democrat Maryland, a longtime member of House Democratic leadership. "I understand the frustration that many members feel about some of the policies and actions of the current Israeli government," Hoyer said on the House floor. "However, this amendment would embolden the enemies of peace, those pursuing the complete elimination of Israel, and those who seek the death of Jews." The opposition underscored the growing concern among Democrats to the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza as the Israel-Hamas war stretches toward its third anniversary. More than 70,000 Palestinians have died, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, since the initial October 7, 2023 terrorist attack that killed more than 1,000 Israelis and foreign nationals. The representatives from Massachusetts, all of whom are Democrats, all voted to slash aid to Israel. Here are segments from their public statements. Representative Richard Neal: "The United States remains committed to our strong strategic alliance with Israel and will continue to defend its sovereignty and right to exist as a secure Jewish state. We also have a responsibility to ensure that governments receiving our aid meet the standard our values and laws require. What we are seeing in the Middle East is not sustainable and demands a new path grounded in peace, security, and the right to self-determination for all." Representative Seth Moulton: "We cannot continue to condone Netanyahu's actions that are against our moral conscience and our own national security interests by perpetuating the status quo." And Representative Jake Auchincloss: "The authority from Congress to finance and sell American-made weapons to allies is a grant of trust to both the presidential administration and its counterparty heads of government. With their disastrous war against Iran, their empowerment of settler violence in the West Bank, and their strategic incoherence against Islamist terrorism, both President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu have sacrificed that trust. Congress must act where the executives have failed." Representative Jim McGovern, Representative Ayanna Pressley, and Representative Stephen Lynch in a joint statement: As members of Congress, it is our duty to ensure that our constituents' hard-earned money is used in a way that advances America's interests and values. For this reason, we do not support providing an additional $3.3 billion of American taxpayer dollars to be used for Israeli military operations in Gaza and Lebanon, operations which have killed tens of thousands of civilians, led to the indiscriminate destruction of civilian infrastructure, and caused severe and ongoing humanitarian catastrophes. And finally, Representative Lori Trahan. The status quo is unsustainable. Prime Minister Netanyahu has used American military assistance funding to carry out atrocities in Gaza, embolden violent settlers in the West Bank, and continue indiscriminate bombing in Lebanon. He has shown us again and again that he does not respond to reason. He responds only to direct pressure. It is not a break from what I believe. I have always affirmed Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state and its right to defend itself from attack. This vote doesn't change that. The Franklin Food Pantry is seeking additional volunteers as demand for food assistance reaches an all-time high. The organization is looking for individuals to help with weekday operations, according to a community announcement. Volunteers are expected to handle physically demanding tasks, such as lifting and moving heavy boxes and maintaining energy throughout fast-paced shifts. The increased need for support has placed added pressure on pantry operations, making volunteer participation essential to maintaining daily services, according to the announcement. Tasks may involve organizing inventory, assisting with distribution, and ensuring supplies are accessible for residents who rely on the pantry. The opportunity offers participants a direct way to support neighbors facing food insecurity. Volunteers can see firsthand how their contributions affect local families and individuals, according to the announcement. The organization stresses that while the work can be physically challenging, it also provides a meaningful way to engage with the community and contribute to a critical support system. Those interested in volunteering can apply online by visiting www.franklinfoodpantry.org/volunteer. Additional information is available by contacting Laura Doherty, Associate Director, at ldoherty@franklinfoodpantry.org. The Reverend Leo B. Shea, who is now retired and living in Sudbury, celebrated his 60th anniversary of ordination as a Mary Knoll missioner on Sunday, June 26, marking a lifetime of service that has taken him from Venezuela to China and beyond. Shea is among 21 Mary Knollers, members of a Catholic foreign mission movement who serve the poor in Africa, Asia, and the Americas, who were recently honored for their decades of commitment, according to a community announcement. Those celebrations took place at the Catholic Foreign Ministry Society of America headquarters in Ossining, New York. Born in Boston in 1939, Shea is the oldest of three children and is uncle to 28 grandnieces and grandnephews. He was ordained a priest on June 11, 1966, after studies at Boston College and the Mary Knoll School of Theology, according to the announcement. Shea's journey began with a lay mission in Jamaica, followed by assignments in Venezuela, Bolivia, China, and the United States. In Caracas, he lived in a one-room shack without running water, working alongside a pastoral team in the slum area of Nueva Tacagua, according to the announcement. He later served as regional superior in Venezuela and co-director of the Commission of Justice and Peace of SECORV, the Conference of Men and Women Religions in Venezuela. Shea also helped chauffeur Mother Teresa during her visit to Caracas. In 1990, Shea was elected Vicar General of the Mary Knoll Society and played key roles in establishing the Mary Knoll Society Review Board, the Mary Knoll Lay Mission Association of the Faithful, and the Chinese Seminary Teachers and Formators Project, according to the announcement. Now retired, Shea continues to support Mustard Seed Communities orphans in Jamaica and enjoys spending time with his family. Recently, Amazon.com published Father Leo's memoirs entitled, I Took the Road Less Traveled By, and That Has Made All the Difference. As reports of immigration enforcement activity continue to circulate throughout Metro West, local advocates say many immigrant residents are increasingly worried about carrying out everyday activities. Advocates say some residents are avoiding public spaces, seeking legal guidance, and turning to community groups for support and concerns about amid concerns about federal immigration enforcement. In response, volunteers have expanded efforts to monitor U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, activity and assist immigrant families. Leela Ramachandran, co-executive director at the Metro West Workers Center in Framingham, told the Daily News that families are still seeing devastation every day as family members are being taken into ICE custody. The center is an immigrant worker-led organization that provides services to workers in the region. "We're still seeing devastation among families," Ramachandran said. "It doesn't feel like the pace has slowed at all." Ramachandran said families continue to be impacted as relatives are taken into ICE custody, particularly through activity tied to the agency's Burlington field office that oversees enforcement activity throughout New England. The facility serves as a check-in administration center and has increasingly been used to hold detainees. "In Metro West in particular, I think there continue to be a lot of arrests at Burlington ICE facilities and while people are going to courts," Ramachandran said. "I think that continues to beg the question around how do people participate in spaces that they are supposed to go? They're trying to follow the rules, then still get picked up." ICE did not immediately return a Daily News request for comment. Framingham is also home to an ICE-sensitive supervision appearance program, ISAP, facility on Speen Street. According to ICE's website, the program serves as an alternative to detention, allowing participants to remain in their communities while being monitored through ankle bracelets or a mobile phone application. The program has been in place since 2004, with the number of participants in the program increasing over time. The ATD ISAP program utilizes case management and technology tools to support aliens' compliance with release conditions while on ICE's non-detained docket. ATD ISAP also increases court appearances rates, ICE states on the website. For the past 10 months, demonstrators have gathered outside the facility every Tuesday morning to protest its presence. Some participants are affiliated with Loose Immigration Justice Network, a statewide organization whose Framingham Street team monitors reports of ICE and operates a hotline where residents can report enforcement activity. Mark Ainscow, a volunteer with the Metro West Loose Hub, told the Daily News that volunteers in Marlboro, Framingham, and Milford help identify ICE activity. When arrests occur, volunteers try to connect families with attorneys, mutual aid resources, and other forms of support. Ainscow said one reason for the weekly demonstrations is that many residents remain unaware the office exists. "I still feel surprised that people don't know that it's there," he said. "A majority of people in Framingham don't know this office exists. It's kind of happening right under our noses." While Ainscow said arrests had previously occurred at the ISAP facility, he's observed fewer incidents recently. Ainscow said ICE activity in Framingham often occurs in waves. He said Loose volunteers have observed enforcement surges in June 2025 and September 2025 and have noticed a growing number of agents in the area since the spring. "Enforcement activity has remained especially visible around Framingham District Court," he said. Volunteers have reported seeing agents waiting for individuals to leave court before approaching them, though Ainscow said that activity decreased during a temporary Trump administration suspension of vehicle stops following a fatal shooting during ICE operation in Maine. The suspension has since been lifted. Ramachandran said the effects of immigration enforcement extend beyond arrests, creating economic hardship for many families. "It really is a cascading effect that is contributing to economic insecurity," she said. "Also, at this moment, a lot of employers are without enough employees, especially when there are raids because people are afraid to leave their homes." She said some workers are losing wages and struggling to afford transportation to jobs, school, and other activities. "The fear also affects children," she said, with some families reluctant to send children to school. "I think immigration enforcement is robbing children of their ability to learn," Ramachandran said. "We have seen children detained, students detained, including in Framingham." Framingham Public Schools enrollment has declined by more than 750 students in 2 years, a trend district leaders have said is due in part to federal immigration policies and concerns among immigrant families. Ainscow thinks many Framingham residents appear uncomfortable with ICE's presence in the city, though public awareness of activity may have faded. "I think people are less aware," he said. "I think that maybe some people think that it stopped happening, but it really hasn't." As enforcement tactics continue to evolve, Ainscow said volunteers are still trying to understand what the long-term landscape will look like and identify the new normal. Singer and New England native Noah Cahan made a surprise appearance at Governor Maura Healey's press conference on July 16th to push for cheaper concert tickets. Healey was announcing her Great Divide Act to crack down on resale concert ticket prices when a red rotary phone next to her rang. It was Cahan on the line. "The artist community and fans would greatly benefit from limiting ticket scalping and the sale of speculative tickets," Cahan said. "I love my fans and I want to protect them however I can." Cahan supported similar legislation in Vermont earlier this year. Now he's throwing his weight behind Healey's bill, which proposes a cap on resale ticket prices and service fees as well as ban so-called ghost tickets. The Great Divide Act seeks to lower sports and concert ticket resale prices and make having fun more affordable, Senator Dylan Fernandez, Democrat Falmouth, said at the press conference. The legislation would make it so no concert ticket can be resold for more than 110% of the original ticket price, meaning that a $200 concert ticket could only go up to $220. It would also cap ticket resale marketplace service fees at 10% of the listed resale price for sporting and non-sporting events. The bill would also ban ghost or speculative tickets, which are tickets that the seller does not actually have when they list them for sale. Healy said that some World Cup fans bought tickets that ended up not existing. Finally, the bill would prevent resellers from tricking consumers into thinking they are buying directly from the artist or venue and from misleading consumers about the ticket supply. Healy is planning on filing the legislation in her closeout supplemental budget. Fernandez said it could also be added as an amendment to the Senate's Economic Development Bill. The full title of the legislation is An Act Relative to Closing the Great Divide Between Ticket Prices and Affordability. It's named in honor of Kahan, who recently became the first artist to headline four consecutive sold-out shows at Fenway Park, according to the governor's office. His latest album is titled The Great Divide. Healy used Kahan's concert to illustrate why her legislation is necessary. Did anyone get tickets to Noah Kahan? She asked. Those tickets were a hot commodity and really hard to come by. She explained some fans may have had to pay more than triple the original ticket price. It's infuriating. It's unfair. And it costs way too much, Healy said. In the 6 months since a tractor trailer slammed into Uxbridge police officer Stephen LaPorta on Route 146, the investigation into his death has remained largely opaque, with authorities mum on whether charges will be sought. LaPorta died January 7th when he was struck by the truck while assisting another motorist on an icy stretch of the roadway. The Office of Worcester County District Attorney Joseph D. Early, Jr. has said the case remains under investigation, sharing no updates on the case. Uxbridge Police Chief Mark Montminy previously confirmed to the Telegram and Gazette that the inquiry is not being directed by his department. The crash, which occurred after midnight, came on a night of particularly bad road conditions in the area. On-duty officers described Route 146 as an ice rink, according to recordings of police radio transmissions from the night of the collision. LaPorta, 43, was outside of cruiser when he was hit, according to authorities. He was pronounced dead at the scene. The driver of the tractor trailer was transported to the hospital with minor injuries. A yellow rig remained on scene after daybreak. In the immediate aftermath of LaPorta's death, there was an outpouring of support from the local law enforcement community and beyond. Efforts to honor the officer and support his wife, Shannon LaPorta, and son Matthew have continued. Massachusetts lawmakers are considering a bill that would posthumously promote LaPorta to the rank of sergeant to allow his surviving spouse to receive a higher retirement benefit. The bill was filed by Senator Ryan Fatman, Republican, Westminster. July 30th, Deep Pond Farm and Stables in East Taunton is hosting a fundraiser for LaPorta's family, with other local businesses donating items for a raffle. Cases of cyclosporiasis, a parasitic foodborne illness that can cause explosive diarrhea, are on the rise in the United States. State and federal health officials have confirmed 1,645 cases, while more than 5,100 additional cases are also being investigated, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Confirmed or suspected cases have been reported in 34 states, and CDC officials said a cluster of cases in Michigan, Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky are likely connected. However, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, DPH, said there is no evidence that the cyclosporiasis outbreak affecting the Midwest is affecting Massachusetts, although there have been a smattering of cases in the state this year. Seasonal increases in cases are common this time of year, the department said. Cyclosporiasis is caused by Cyclospora chitinensis, a parasite often found on produce. Taco Bell has removed ingredients from some locations in what it said was a precautionary measure, but the CDC hasn't publicly identified a common supplier, distributor, or business behind the cases. Unlike most bacterial foodborne illnesses that resolve within a few days, cyclosporiasis can lead to gastrointestinal symptoms that linger for weeks or even longer, according to the Food and Drug Administration. As of July 1, 18 cases of cyclosporiasis have been confirmed in Massachusetts, according to data from the Department of Public Health. The next update to the data is scheduled for the first week of August, DPH said. The current number of cases is consistent with what the Bay State typically sees this time of year, the department said. The CDC defines the annual cyclosporiasis season as May 1 through August 31. Last year, 74 cases were reported in the state, according to DPH data. In 2024, 84 cases were confirmed, while 97 were reported in 2023. The last time Massachusetts recorded more than 100 cases was in 2019, when 211 cases were reported. In the U.S., people can become sick with cyclosporiasis by eating contaminated, uncooked produce, according to DPH. Previous outbreaks have been linked to fresh produce such as raspberries, fresh basil, cilantro, scallions, snow peas, and bagged salad, the department said. Outside the U.S. in areas where cyclospora is endemic, people can also become sick by drinking contaminated water, according to DPH. People typically start noticing cyclosporiasis symptoms about 1 week after eating food or drinking water infected with cyclospora, according to the CDC. Most common symptoms of cyclosporiasis are watery or explosive diarrhea, loss of appetite, weight loss, cramping, bloating, increased gas, nausea, fatigue. Less common symptoms may include vomiting, body aches, headache, low-grade fever, or other flu-like symptoms. The Massachusetts House passed an animal welfare bill on July 15th that addresses animal neglect and helps service animals ride Ubers, but does not include a pet shop ban that the Senate had championed. In March, the Senate passed their version of the Pets Act, which included a ban on the sale of cats and dogs at pet shops. They celebrated the bill, saying it would end the inhumane puppy mill to pet store pipeline. However, opponents said the legislation would not stop people from purchasing dogs from puppy mills and would instead punish responsible pet stores that do not work with puppy mills. An amendment from Representative Natalie Higgins, Democrat Leominster, to include the ban on the sale of dogs, cats, and rabbits in new pet shops was withdrawn on Wednesday, and the final bill does not include the pet shop ban. House spokespeople did not immediately return a request for comment on why it was dropped, but they told State House News Service on Wednesday that the House decided to focus on other areas. The two chambers will have to come to a compromise before the bill can go to the governor's desk. The bill passed 151-1, with Representative John Gaskey, Republican Carver, as the only member in opposition. The House's version of the animal welfare bill creates a sweeping set of regulations that tackles neglect cases, pet ownership, veterinary care, and kennel laws, among other issues. If there is any issue that we can all agree on, it's that all of our furry friends deserve long, happy lives, Representative Jack Patrick Lewis, Democrat Framingham, said in a statement. This legislation is a strong step towards that goal. We are employing robust measures to promote good caretaking and penalize bad actors, such as expanding policy related to veterinary technicians and pet insurance, banning the use of animals in household product safety research, and adding new oversight to the kennel industry. Here are some of the measures included in the bill. Some are the same as the Senate-passed bill, while others were added by the House. Establishes a local process for addressing cases of animal neglect, such as allowing an animal control officer to remove a pet from its owner if the owner fails to provide adequate food, water, shelter, or veterinary care. Strengthens oversight and reporting on dog kennels, including allowing for the revocation of a license if the kennel is not being maintained in a humane manner. Directs the Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities to create a pet ownership program for residents of public housing, including a limit on pet deposits and a prohibition on discriminating based on a pet's breed, size, weight, or appearance. Prohibits manufacturers from testing cosmetic or household products on animals if there are alternative test methods. Requires rideshare companies to include a feature on their app that tells the driver that the rider will have a service animal. Offenders would face a $500 fine for a first offense. And creates licensing standards for veterinary technicians. The Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation and Eversource are celebrating the completion of the newest section of the Mass Central Rail Trail with a ribbon cutting on July 16th in Sudbury. The event highlights the Sudbury-Hudson Transmission Reliability Project, as well as the opening of the new section of the rail trail, according to a community announcement. The effort pairs electric grid updates with expanded public recreation access. The event will feature remarks from state and local officials, project partners, and community leaders, followed by a bike ride along the newly opened trail segment hosted by the Mass Central Rail Trail Alliance, according to the announcement. The project involved the installation of a 9-mile underground transmission line between Eversource's Sudbury substation and the Hudson Light and Power substation, strengthening electric system reliability for Greater Boston. The line supports connections to energy resources and regional electrification and decarbonization goals. About 7.6 miles of the line were placed along an inactive Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority railroad corridor, creating a base for the new trail segment, according to the announcement. The completed trail section adds walking, running, and biking opportunities while linking into a growing statewide network. Amenities include road crossings, benches, signage, landscaping, and the restored Diamond Junction, once the intersection of the Framingham and Lowell Railroad and Massachusetts Central Railroad. The segment is part of a broader trail planned to connect 26 communities across 104 miles from Boston to Northampton, according to the announcement. The 7.5-mile trail section runs through the Wayside Corridor from Hudson through Stowe to Sudbury. Work included habitat improvements, invasive species removal, and native plantings. Call it a summer of transition for Braden Lewis. He started it as a Division III college player and a member of the local American Legion team. He will end it in two entirely different places. The 2025 Hopedale High graduate recently joined the Worcester Bravehearts after starting a second season with Post 59 in Milford. In the fall, thanks to a standout freshman season at Wheaton College, Lewis will make the jump to Division I when he transfers to Northeastern University. He has yet to make an appearance for the Bravehearts of the Wooden Bat Futures Collegiate Baseball League, but is looking forward to joining a Northeastern team that has won the Coastal Athletic Association tournament the past two seasons. I'm super excited to get there. The coaching staff showed a lot of interest in me. When I toured the campus, I loved it a lot, and I knew I wanted to go there, Lewis said. In his only season at Wheaton, he was named New Mac Rookie of the Year and to the American Baseball Coaches Association / Rawlings All-Region 1 First Team, the first Wheaton freshman to earn All-Region status since 2012. Lewis led the conference in stolen bases, 29 without being caught, and ranked fourth with 10 home runs. He was one of five players nationwide to have as many as 29 steals and not be thrown out. He also had a 17-game hitting streak. Braden had a great year for us and developed a lot from the fall to the spring, Wheaton coach Dan Tischler said. That development is a testament to his work ethic, passion for the game, and dedication. He had a consistent year from start to finish. He'll be a welcome addition at Northeastern, which loses two-time All-American Harrison Feinberg to eligibility and Franklin's Ryan Garrity, who recently signed a free agent contract with the San Diego Padres organization. It's going to be a good challenge, Lewis said, of playing in Division I for the Huskies. Pitchers are obviously going to throw harder and be better. I'm just going to have to work hard at what I do to hopefully get an opportunity to play. Lewis hit .329 at Wheaton and led the team in slugging, .596, runs 42, RBIs 36, and home runs. I worked super hard this offseason to play right away at Wheaton, and that helped me a lot, he said. Just believing in myself to do well. That's all it really takes, a lot of mental preparation. I think that'll really help me play right away at Northeastern. Lewis leaves Post 59 team that went 18-3 during the regular season and earned the number 2 seed for the District 4 tournament. Milford will host the State Legion tournament on July 25th through 29th. He had kind words for Post 59 manager Steve DeVito. I've known him for a long time, Lewis said. He's been wanting me to play there forever. It's great to play there. Milford has a legacy around it. It has such a rich history in the town of Milford. DeVito reciprocated praise back in Lewis's direction. We are very happy for Braden to be joining the Huskies. A lot of hard work went into his getting to this point, DeVito said. This has been a long-term goal for him to be able to compete at the D1 level. He's self-motivated and will do whatever he can to make sure he's successful. Lewis joins a Bravehearts team that includes local players Jake Shaughnessy of Franklin, Ian Carter of Milford, and Jeremy Krendel of Framingham St. Mark's. At Northeastern, Lewis will continue to be a finance major and hopefully a power hitter for head coach Mike Glavine. His coaching philosophy is what pushed me to want to go there, Lewis said. I'm super excited to play for him. And the success there, they're a super good baseball program. The school, academic-wise, is really good. It can help set me up later on in life. You've been listening to a reading of the Milford Daily News. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening.
Hello, listeners. Would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.